Hi, I'm Brian Sullivan, Security Program Manager with Microsoft. And here with me today are Dave Weinstein, Senior Security Engineer, and Jason Shirk, Security Program Manager, both with Microsoft. So welcome, guys.
Hi.
Thanks, Brian.
So tell us what you're going to be talking about at Blue Hat.
So we've done a whole lot of research around the area of fuzzing. I actually own fuzzing strategy here at Microsoft. And Dave is one of my developers who works heavily on it.
And usually against Jason.
Now, before you guys get too far into it, if someone's watching who doesn't really understand what fuzzing means.
There are a lot of technical terms, but fuzzing essentially means you're throwing garbage at the program and waiting to see how it falls over. If you've never done any security work on it, the usual answer is it falls over remarkably quickly. The technical description we usually give, it's the deliberate use of malformed data to find vulnerabilities in software. In practice, something that's never been hardened, you can send pure random data at and have it explode. That's great if you're the security guy or the tester. If you're the developer, you usually have a slightly different view of how things went.
Right. Really? So they just fall over that easy?
Oh, look, people don't write parsers very well, but we put parsers in almost everything we do. And it's even worse if you own both halves. I own the code that writes the file. I also wrote the code that reads the file. I know what the valid values are. I'm going to write them out and read them in, and in a lot of software, you've got tools. You never actually touch the file directly. You use a tool that touches the file. And historically speaking, if you were going through development on a shipping product, and someone said, hey, you know, this file causes the software to crash. Whoa, why did the tool write it? Oh, no, the tool didn't write it, I just generated one. Okay, we're not fixing that, that's not a bug, we only take data. And the problem is, attackers don't play by those rules. So you wrote the data one way and read it the same way and everything is fine. If you've got an attacker, if you've got a bad guy out there trying to take advantage of you, they're going to break all those rules and you're going to explode in unpleasant ways. So if you look at it, people generally don't handle the error case well.
So most software development, there's positive testing done, where they test to make sure that the software does certain things. We're in the business of negative testing, where we make sure that the software only does those things that it's supposed to do, and we look for everything else.
So the easiest way to think of it is, we're pretty clear on the fact that if it's supposed to do something and it doesn't, that's a bug. What happens if there's no definition? If we say that, you know, this will always be 0, 1, 2, or 3, and if it's 0, do this, if it's 1, do that, if it's 2, do this, if it's 3, do the third thing, and I pass in 97.
Or an A.
Or an A, or anything else. And generally, you can see those red areas. They'll say, if this is not true, the results are undefined. Undefined being, you know, developer speak for, something's going to happen, and I take no responsibility for it, and it's your own fault, and don't talk to me. Or occasionally, undefined means it's going to be bad, and I don't want to do the work to figure out how bad. And that was all well and good, you know, 20, 30 years ago, but those days have been and gone, and you have to assume that there's a malicious person who's going to take advantage of any mistake you make. And that's The trick to fuzzing is that normally we have a problem in that if someone's developing software, that's what they specialize in, especially if it's a specialized piece of software. If you're talking about particular subspecialties where they're really good at certain tasks, they focus their career efforts, their skill efforts, everything at doing this. It is unreasonable to go in and say, you know what, you need to be an expert in all that, but we also want to make you a security expert. Here are all these conferences, here are all these websites, here are all these books. You go learn. By the way, you need to be able to do that tomorrow. It's not a reasonable thing to say. It's not a reasonable thing to assume that everyone has to be a specialist in everything. The nice thing about fuzzing is that it doesn't require you to be a specialist. You don't have to say, is it possible that an attacker could make this happen? Because it did. If we want to know, if an attacker gives me a bad file, will I crash? And I give you a bad file, and you crash, it's now not theoretical. It's real. It happened. And that sort of leads into the second part of our talk, and what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow, which is not all crashes are created equal. Some crashes are more equal than others. And I should say, all crashes are bad, and you should fix all your crashes. By the same token, both Jason and I should exercise more, eat less, you know, that sort of thing. People don't do what we're supposed to do. And when you're looking in development at what went wrong, traditionally we've always gone with the more often it happens, the more important it is. If I get a crash that happens 10% of the time, then we have to fix it. If I get a crash that happens, you know, one time in 10,000, it might slip through a triage. if I get a crash that only happens if I give it a deliberately bad file, it gets punted immediately if you're looking at things traditionally. So how do you know what bugs to fix? And the problem is, analyzing a bug to see how bad it is does take security expertise. Moreover, it takes security expertise that has to stay abreast of the state of the art.
Is that where like the fuzzer comes in, is to kind of like build that knowledge
the
in?
The fuzzer creates the bad data, but now I've got a crash, and a crash is bad, but a crash can simply be it crashed, I have to restart the program, and a crash can mean a sophisticated attacker can take over your computer and sell it on the black market. So what do you do? And again, the problem is that exploitation technology advances. Things that 5-6 years ago were considered unexploitable now are considered pretty trivially exploitable. It's not reasonable to assume that, again, someone who's a developer making software is going to be an expert in exploiting software. And so we are announcing a piece of technology. It's an extension to the Windows debugger called Bang Exploitable. Windows debugger commands all start with the extensions are introduced with a little bang. And what it is it actually looks at the crash dump, and it applies a set of rules that we've developed internally, and it uses those to try and figure out what it can tell you about the crash. There's some types of crashes where we say this is exploitable. In fact, the indication of the crash is you were actually exploited. If there had been a real exploit there, it was over. There's some things that we'll say are probably exploitable. We believe that a skilled attacker could make this work. There are a lot of things where we say we don't know. A human has to look at it. And there are a handful of things, like a divide by zero, where we say, you know what, that's probably not exploitable. We'll never say anything isn't exploitable because the state of the art gets better. But what we're trying to do is say, look, if it's exploitable or probably exploitable, fix it. If it's unknown, investigate it. If it's a divide by zero, you should probably fix it. You should fix it, and if you're early in development, you really should fix it. And other than that, someone's going to have to make a call. The exciting news is, so we've been betaing this internally. The exciting news, which I guess we'll be announcing tomorrow, and people seeing it here will be discovering when the podcast goes live, is that we are going to release this extension outside of Microsoft in fiscal year 09, so between now and the end of June.
Fantastic. That's excellent news. So we've got this great tool now that we're going to find out if the results of the fuzz are in fact exploitable. Mm-hmm. But there's an earlier question than that, which is, you know, how do you fuzz? And more to the point, it's not like you send the program one malformed input and mm-hmm. you know it'll automatically break, right? The odds are slim, right?
So we automate the process very heavily. We'll take the example of a web page where we have a field that is looking for age, a field that's looking for a yes, no, and a hidden field. Okay, and it's the age field is pretty easy to define. It's going to be some number between probably one and a three-digit number. Right, the yes, no field should just be a y or an n or a yes or a no. We shouldn't accept any other data. And the hidden field, we really don't know what that is. If you're looking at the page. And so you're expecting particular inputs. So we would build a tool that would go in and let's try a negative number. Let's try a special character. Let's try for the age field a 40-digit number. Let's see what happens. Let's send it letters. And you automate across all the fields with these fuzzers to figure out the bad things that are going to happen.
And how much do you... I mean, like, because there's literally an infinite number of different ways to test it, right?
And primarily, what most of the fuzzers that are used are probabilistic fuzzers. They toss random numbers and do something. The third part of our talk, actually, is how do you know when you've fuzzed enough? And mm-hmm. unfortunately, the drawback to any kind of a probabilistic attack is, by definition, you haven't exhausted the problem space. Theoretically, if you tried every single permutation, it would work, but you're also looking at, you know, a test cycle that approaches the heat death of the universe. Maybe great for job security, you know, with the economy, people might want to make a play that we have to keep testing until, you know, the Earth is enveloped by the sun, but not really practical if you actually want to ship software. And so we go into some actual heuristic measurements that we've done on what the curve looks like, how things look, and what are good rules of thumb for when you're done fuzzing. But to answer your earlier question, it's important not to overthink what you do to the data. I mean, something as simple as going through and one in a million times inverting a bit in just data is enough to cause exploitable crashes on something that's never been hardened before. Taking a string and inject, traditionally people inject just a huge number of capital A's. There they go, right through the system. There are a lot of things, but fuzzing really is random garbage. And there are ways you can make it smarter. For example, you have to get the bad data to whatever component it is you're trying to test. So for example, if you are reading an XML file, which, you know, I think at this point every piece of new software written in the last 5 years reads some form of XML, if I start randomly injecting less thans, I'm not actually testing your software. I'm testing the XML parser that you happen to be using. Now, hopefully, your XML parser can stand up to that. Now, if you wrote your own XML parser, this is a good thing to test. But assuming you're using a well-tested, well-secured XML parser, I'm never hitting your code in the first place. I've got no insight into what's happening in your code. So what I'd want to do then is I'd want to write a fuzzer that was smart enough to say, okay, here's the value of the XML tag. I want to fuzz that. Here's an attribute. I want to fuzz that. What happens if I delete this tag? What happens if I copy this tag multiple times? But again, the key thing in fuzzing is you have to get the bad data to the parser that you're attacking. And
but I want to take this opportunity to talk people out of trying to write your own XML parsers. There are a lot of excellent XML parsers out there, so please.
The wheel is already nice and round. Really no need to make your own.
Right. So we base some of our data on kind of when you know you can stop, on particularly our Vista fuzzing push, which was about 350 million fuzzing iterations, which is a pretty large data set.
That's a big set.
We certainly got some interesting information out of that.
So you mentioned some heuristics. So can you, can you talk about that? Are you willing to share the numbers?
Sure, we'll talk a little bit about it.
Leave us something for the slide deck. We want people to go and download the presentation and see us in all our splendor.
That's fine.
Give us a
That's
little
fine.
Bit of a tease.
Okay.
Right, but we can say that we fuzzed across about 250 different parsers. And there's some really interesting data about at what point in fuzzing, how many iterations in, you kind of reach not critical mass, but a point of diminishing returns for buggy parsers and for all the bugs that you may find.
So
and
it's
those
like
two
most,
are really
most of the bugs you're going to find, you find pretty early
well,
in the process?
Not necessarily,
not,
no.
That's not true. You can literally say you fuzz 100,000 times and you find nothing, and you fuzz 7 times and you find 2 major crashes. Mm-hmm. That's the downside to a probabilistic approach. Now, what we can say is, of all the bugs we found, this is how they came out on the curve.
Yes.
We can't, by definition, can't say we found all the bugs. And the real question on when have you fuzzed enough is not, should you stop fuzzing? Because if you can, it's always a good thing to get more data. The question is, what's the most effective use of your time? Because, again, in a real world, you have a limited amount of time, you have a limited amount of hardware. You've got a limited amount of developer and test attention. So the question becomes, I could test this parser 2 million times, or I could test these 4 parsers 500,000 times. Mm-hmm. What's the difference in the coverage?
Right.
And we actually have numbers, and we're not going to tell them to you unless you want to.
One example, though, that I'll give you out of the numbers, and it's a small example, is past about 1.5 million iterations, it's almost a million iterations before you hit your next bug across the parsers that we tested. So it becomes much less probable that you're going to find a parser in the or a bug in the parser in the time it would take you to go and find other bugs in other parsers or to change your approach. Because the rule of thumb in fuzzing is if you change your approach, you find different bugs.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay. And we are going to go, we've done, again, more internal testing. And we have found, we've got descriptions of what different fuzzing approaches found. And it really is a case where there are strong advantages to trying multiple approaches. And again, I want to get back to fuzzing is inherently a pragmatic discipline. It's probably the most accessible of the security tool set to anyone who isn't a security specialist because it's really straightforward. I throw a whole bunch of things at the wall and I see what sticks. And because of that, it's really easy for someone to get their teeth into. You can sit down in the course of half an hour and come up with a new approach and just try it. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And you go on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, give us a takeaway for the audience, something they can act on hopefully as soon as possible in their code to fuzz away.
So it would be to take multiple approaches, I'd say, where you might have a mutational fuzzer, which is a fuzzer that takes known good data and changes it in random ways, and that's your only approach that you're taking. Add a generational fuzzer also, which understands the rule set of the data and generates new data, because you'll find different things. Also, be certain not to be too strict in following the rules of whatever parser it is that you're running against. Because if you don't ever check the tags in the XML, we'll say, you'll never find the problem in the XML parser itself.
Jason's being more of an optimist than I am. My first statement is that you have to assume that if you are a popular application and you consume any data from someone else, whether that's a file, whether that's network traffic, whether it's a SOAP request, whatever it is, that if you're popular, that somewhere there is a bad guy who is going to try and break you. Mm-hmm. And so what you need to do is look at those inputs and do a simple fuzzer. You know, have something that randomly makes SOAP requests at you. Have something that takes your files and flips bits at random. Inject random data. For that matter, just generate random data if you have to. But get some coverage. Because if you've got nothing, you're low-hanging fruit and you're an easy target. In a real sense, we have the harder job. What we're trying to do as part of this is to try and help everybody build stronger software. It's part of what our mandate is. As an individual software developer, your job is to create software that's better than the surrounding environment. There's an old joke, two guys are in the mountains, and all of a sudden they startle a bear. And they start to run, and one guy stops and starts tightening his shoes. And his friend looks at him and says, "You're not going to outrun that bear." He says, "I don't have to outrun the bear. I have to outrun you." So from an independent developer standpoint, you want to be not the low-hanging fruit. Because the bad guys are doing this for money. And so what they're looking for is large market share, which pretty much everybody wants, and easy vulnerabilities. So your job is to get that large market share and not have the easy vulnerabilities. We know that for any sufficiently large software, there are going to be problems. It just needs to be easier than someone takes a dumb fuzzer and throws it at it, and 30 seconds later, they've got you.
Awesome. It's going to be a great talk. Really looking forward to it. Thanks, guys, for doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you.